They want me to get rid of my dog. Can they do that?
I'm being fined for leaving my garage door open too long.
What are covenants? Do I have any rights?
Help, I feel like I've left the American zone.
If you want the answers to those questions, join me, Sue Bartholomew, and my guests on The Commons every Saturday from 2 to 3 right here on WBR Fairfax Radio. We'll ask the experts and we'll untangle the truth about what's left of our property rights.
On the Commons is a weekly radio show dedicated to discussing the many issues surrounding mandatory membership homeowners associations. Join us as we explore this relatively new world of controlled living, which includes condominiums, cooperatives, and both attached and detached single-family homes. Living in a common ownership development means giving up the American dream. It means giving up your constitutional rights and control over your most valuable asset, your home. Living in a homeowners association means leaving the American zone. This is On the Commons, and I am Sue Bartholomew. Radio Fairfax. Joining us today, we have David Kahn. David, thank you so much for joining us. I hope the weather's nice in Texas this morning.
It was a wet weekend, and we're dry now.
You're dry now. But when the rains came before, the biggest hurricane on record, Texas had its, what, third, fourth conference for homeowners?
Yeah, I think we've had, it depends on how you describe them, but this was one of our two best conferences in terms of the energy and the ideas that came out. I think we've had a total of four, at least. We had you come up to at least one. And
I think I was there for two of them, actually.
Okay, so then we may be up to five. It's very invigorating to bring people together, and our theme for this year was let's look and learn from what happened at the most recent legislative session, let's honor one of our stalwarts, and let's begin the planning process for Texas' next legislative session, which happens in January 2017, our legislature comes once every 2 years.
So you have a whole year to prepare for it?
Everybody has a whole year to prepare for it. So we do, and so do the forces of the attorneys and the management companies. And we felt by the end that we came out with a solidly good year, and basically we had some good accomplishments in the legislature, and we built some relationships, and we reviewed that at the conference, and then we got some ideas about where to go during the session, where to go next time around, and we got some additional ideas at our conference.
That sounds great. What are some of the better ideas? What do you want to tell us about it? What's unique? What's different? What are you excited about?
Well, I'm excited about two categories of things, really. The most important is that we have an increasingly educated and enthusiastic group of advocates. We had probably our largest sign up ever, somewhere between 75 and 90 people signed up. We did, as you noted, have a terrible rainstorm, although we didn't have the hurricane that was in Mexico. So that cut our numbers down, but the people who came, some of whom from 4 hours away, knew their issues and really were prepared to work, and that was one of the things that came out really well at the conference. The part of my own personal enthusiasm comes from the fact that we had a good session where, although we started behind the eight ball, we finished very strong. And So I feel that we came away from the legislative session confirming some strength that we had. We got increased legislative awareness. We got increased credibility. We made new allies. We kept some of the old allies, and we learned about places where we need to do some more work. So that was very exciting, and we came away with some major wins in the legislature, which is not always easy to do. In fact, it's rarely easy to do.
So can you tell us about them?
Sure. I would say that I think we had several major wins in the session, and I'd like to go through a couple because I think they highlight issues that come up again and again, and we found some good ways to deal with them. The first issue that comes up again and again is open meetings. And that has been a hot topic in every legislative session that I remember going back maybe 10 years. And what unfortunately happens is that some directors seem to feel that their preference for efficiency and consolidation of control trumps the owner's interest in understanding what's going on. And, of course, we've always gone the other way on that. And there have been two techniques that have been used to shut owners out. And one of those is simply holding meetings in private. And one of those is holding meetings by telephone. And so one of the advantages that we got from this session is that now if the open meeting is supposed to be done and the directors choose to do so by telephone or by Skype or by anything else that gets invented electronically, they have to allow all homeowners to participate, in the sense of all homeowners have to have a chance to listen in on an equal basis. So your sound has to actually work. You can't say, oh, we're going to put a speakerphone in the middle of a big conference hall and the three people near the speakerphone might be able to hear. You're going to have to use one of those services that allows everybody to dial in. That may cut down on the number of meetings by conference call, which may be a good thing, because then the face-to-face meetings have many advantages. But there can be times when a conference call is a good idea, especially in some of the larger subdivisions. And that's fine as long as everybody can, in that sense, participate. The second set of issues that we frequently run into is a big debate over what must be done in an open meeting. And we got a substantial expansion of the list. There had been 8 categories of issues, and now there are 15. But the major thing is that the whether it's borrowing money or electing replacement directors or raising assessments, all of those things, the statute now clearly says must be done in an open meeting. And so that was our first win that I think is significant.
Let me ask you, David, that means that you've actually eliminated things that they can discuss in private, in executive session.
That's correct.
Oh, good. Okay.
The statute allows a small number of things to be clearly discussed if the board wants an executive session. So, for example, if there's an issue of whether a homeowner is or is not in compliance with the rules, the board can hold that discussion in executive session, and often for privacy purposes that may be a reasonable decision. I don't know, often, but sometimes for privacy purposes at least, it might be a reasonable decision. If the directors want to discuss competing bids or negotiate contracts, that's commonly done in the business world and in private, and the boards are the ones with that authority. But in order to approve the contract, that must be an executive session. That must be an open session, and that means that dissenting directors can, if they choose, articulate reasons why they don't favor the particular decision. And there are some small number of other issues that can be discussed in the executive session. But what was more important was to clarify the range of other issues. Let's see if I can give you some examples that where there had been some ambiguity and now there is not. The lending or borrowing money was a big deal. We think that if our board is going to be borrowing money and committing us all to pay it back, they need to vote on that and discuss that in public, not in private. Pet projects should not be hidden, and we got that committed to be done in public. Surprisingly, there had been some boards that would try to amend governing documents, and that is now going to be done in public. Approval of the annual budget now needs to be done in public. And you may say, well, these are all obvious, and the answer is, of course they're obvious, but they weren't being always done in public. And, of course, it's the bad boards that were hiding things. The good boards didn't need the statute. They were going to do it anyway.
Yeah.
So sale or purchase of real property, filling a vacancy on the board, new capital improvements like building a clubhouse, all of that needs to be done in public. And these are really basic agenda items that some boards had been concealing. So to have the statute clearly say you've got to do this in public is a major improvement.
So this is actually the law now?
This is now the law in Texas, yeah.
And it went into law when? July, August?
Oh, September 15th.
September 15th. So it's relatively new.
Yeah.
Awesome. Very cool. That's good.
And you know, there already have been questions coming in from homeowners where they say, for example, amending the dedicatory instruments, and they ask, can that be done in private? And now I say, no, cannot be. The second set of issues came big things where I feel we won something new had to do with elections. And one of the strategies that we frequently want to encourage homeowners to try is elect a new board, vote the bums out.
Mm-hmm.
Problem is that some boards made it very difficult to run for office, and there were concerns about the voting procedures, and I want to break those into two parts. The first is that we now have a requirement that, and all of this I should be real clear about, has to do with subdivisions. Single family homes and most townhomes. What I'm talking about does not apply to condominiums, and that's one of the topics of conversation for next year. But in Texas now, if you are in a subdivision that has 100 or more homes, in order to have an election, you have to give notice to everybody, and you have to give everybody the opportunity to run for office. And the notice goes out, and there's a certain period of time during which a person can self-nominate. So the board no longer can control the process using nominating committees and relegating outsiders to running on a write-in basis. The second part of the voting improvements has to do with how we count the ballots. The law in Texas used to be, for homeowner associations, use a secret ballot. session or two ago, the legislators decided to change that to require everyone sign their ballot. And this was due to concerns that the legislature was afraid that not every ballot was getting counted exactly once. At this session, however, there was a quite reasonable complaint that we really prefer secret ballots for two reasons. First, to avoid retaliation.
Mm-hmm.
And second, because the process to count a secret ballot could become expensive, a non-secret ballot, if you had to hire an outside agency. And some of the associations felt they had to hire an outside agency so they could ensure that there was no risk of retaliation, no risk of reporting to the current board who had voted against them. So we agreed that secret ballots were important, but what we wanted, along with secret ballots, was the right to have observers during the counting process. And that proved to be one of the most contentious issues this session. The
Really?
Management companies were adamant that they should be able to count the ballots without observers.
Huh.
Well, but you can maybe understand why if you realize that the management companies get hired by the incumbent board. The insurgents may or may not stay with the management company, and therefore in some cases there is an incentive to favor the incumbents.
No, I fully understand why, but I'm surprised that they actually vocalized that and
fought
against.
Well, they didn't vocalize it that way. What they said was the insurgents have a track record of being loud, nasty people, and that they didn't want to have the smooth process of counting disrupted. Now, one of the reasons this becomes important is the smooth process of counting often involves questions where it's not clear, it's not obvious what the answer is. And I actually just had this happen in a subdivision where I represent a group of insurgents, and there were three seats up for election. And we brought a whole lot of people, our group brought a whole lot of people to the meeting. When we went in the back room to count, it turned out that there were maybe 10% of the ballots had some confusing element to them. And
by confusing?
Well, people don't always perfectly fill out ballots.
Okay.
If they say, for example, re-elect the board, you have to interpret what that means. Usually that's clear, but not always. Some people would simultaneously say they were giving a proxy to someone to vote and specifying who they wanted to vote, but they checked the one that said give the discretion to a person rather than saying they have to vote the way I want. So there are various questions come up, and it can be helpful, at least, as in this case, we had lawyers for both the incumbent board, their lawyer, and I was there, chosen by one of the candidates, to watch and make sure the decisions that were made were fair. Since the process of counting in that case took about a half an hour, there were, during that half hour, I guess I should say, there were contentions in the audience, and in fact, the board ordered the audience out of the room. They were in a church. Now, of course, my people say there was no reason to order them out of the room, and I wasn't there, so I can't evaluate it. But it was important that once they had been ordered out, that they had some sense that both I and the person who we brought in as a witness could report that the counting was honest, and in fact, we had won. Our people won the three seats. So it turned out to be very important to have observers, both in our case, we chose to have one fact observer as a witness and myself to be on hand to talk with the lawyer. for the incumbents to make sure that the counting was done reasonably. And everything went very smoothly in the back room. We were not aware of the contentiousness in the front hall.
Isn't it sad that in a neighborhood you're supposed to have, it's supposed to be a community, and I hate using that word in relations to a development in HOA, but that you're no longer neighbors and friends in a community. You're just sort of warriors.
Well, one of the odd things here is that there is a very small cadre of people, two or three, who have been on the board for 10 to 15 years
mm-hmm.
in that particular area, and they, for whatever reason, don't want to give up that power.
It happens all the time, David. I hear from people, oh, I've been there for 20-some years, and we've never had an election.
We now have laws that say not only do you have to have an election, but you get to have observers watch. And so those were two major changes. And the third big win concerned enforcement of non-assessment issues. So what happens if a homeowner is accused of violating a rule? And the law in Texas for many, many years has been that before the association can punish the homeowner in some way, they have to give the owner notice and an opportunity to be heard. Well, the associations came forward with a proposal that would basically have allowed regular mail notice of alleged violations. And all that was originally required was a note to the file where somebody said, property manager or self-managed association, we sent this regular letter on the approximately thus and such a day to an owner. And of course we thought that was ludicrous. And we said it's always been certified mail. Certified mail is the gold standard for making sure that people know what notice has been sent, and there's no reason to change it. It's just not that expensive. Well, that was the other issue that went down to the wire. And what was interesting about this was the whole process, just to back up a step. Early in the session, we had negotiations with representatives of the managers and the lawyers, and we'd been able to work out about 30% of our differences. And then the governor and his office intervened, and we appealed to them, and they supported us to the extent of working out about another 30% of our differences. But these two issues that I've just mentioned, the status of the observers at the election and the issue of having certified mail, were not resolved. And those two big issues were finally resolved on the floor of the Texas House of Representatives when Representative Dwayne Bohack introduced an amendment in the last week of the session to basically follow what I would consider the American way. I think it's widely accepted that in elections you have observers. That's certainly true in Texas elections. And it's widely accepted that you use certified mail for notice. We weren't advocating any major departure from common sense. But it took Representative Bohack to force that issue in the House. And then what was really wonderful was he got a bipartisan crew of about six or seven legislators to stand up and say they supported his amendment. And in addition, some of them said that they themselves had suffered horror stories and essentially made the point that if homeowner associations can pick on people elected to the Texas House of Representatives, my God, what are they going to do to normal people? So that was a very big win in the House, and once we got that, then Senator Royce West, who has in the past introduced some very helpful statutes for homeowners, accepted that into the package that was going to go forward, and it was eventually adopted, and the governor signed it. And so we felt good both about the ultimate result in those various areas, and one of the other issues that we had dealt with had to do with defending the priority of payment system to make sure that if you pay money, it goes to avoid foreclosure. The association industry had again wanted to weaken that, and we successfully defended against that. And as we were defending against that and winning the few additional major improvements, we also were building some credibility for the future, which we think bodes well.
That sounds good. There was a, I don't know if it ever made it into law in Texas, but there seems to be an accepted hierarchy of payment throughout the country in terms of assessments. The first people who get paid when you put in, when you pay your money to the HOA are the collection attorneys. And then it goes to fines and interest and penalties and all of that. And by the time you get down to actually making your payment for your assessment, there's nothing left.
Right, and we had defeated that. We have a different priority of payment scheme in Texas where the first payment you make goes to your assessments, and it stays going to your assessments and your back due assessments until those are paid off, because those are the only things that they can foreclose on. And that had taken several sessions to win, but the legislators, including Senator West, were well aware of that issue and were unwilling to reopen that once we pushed and showed how the industry was trying to weaken that. They felt that was something that, correctly felt, that that was something that, a problem that they had solved, and they didn't want to unsolve it. So we've been, that's one of the victories that we have held on to. Fines should not exist. They are a governmental function, and what's the basis for associations imposing them at all? And we, sometimes we get traction with that argument, especially when the association says they want to fine parents $700 or $800 if their kids skateboard in the subdivision. And sometimes we don't get traction with that issue. And for a variety of reasons, well, in part because we were on the defensive initially, we didn't attack fines directly this session. But we did secure a commitment in the statute to clarify certain issues that the homeowner always has the right to cure. So the associations have been angry because, I don't know why they get angry about it, but they're always angry about,
because they stand to make a lot of money, or at least the people who run them stand to make a lot of money. But
yeah, it's hard to believe they make a lot of money when they forbid garage sales. But a lot of them do. And what the associations wanted was the ability to impose a fine immediately, let me put it this way, without the opportunity to cure the problem. And what they said was, that they knew people who would have a garage sale in January, and then they'd wait 6 months and have one in July, and when the association said, you can't do this, they say, oh, well, we'll cure it, we won't have it again, at least for 6 months. So they got their way on garage sales, but we got the legislature to specify that things like barking dogs, which, it's surprising how often that's used as a retaliatory measure, that somebody will have a dog in their house, and dogs do sometimes bark. And the association will say, well, we want to impose a fine of $100 for your dog because it barked. And the homeowner now has the right to say, no, we'll find a way to deal with that. You know, it's hard to stop a dog from barking, but usually if it's a retaliatory thing, the major concern is just to calm everybody down, and 3 or 4 months later, it's...
You know, barking dogs, you're right. This is one of those questions that comes up, and the association goes after a homeowner, your dog was barking while you were gone, and all of that. And then you find out that it was the board that was actually making the dog bark by being outside the door, by scratching on the door, by doing things to get the dog to bark, which is what the dog is supposed to
right.
do. And then they go, oh, your dog was barking, you know, I heard it, and therefore you're going to get fined. So when you have, they're allowed to take away something that you own for absolutely no other reason than because they don't like you or they have the power to do that. There's no oversight. There's no adult supervision anywhere. These boards are not mature enough, a lot of them, or the managers, are not mature enough to be able to handle these things in an adult way. They're childish, they're immature.
Well, I mean, we have all of those problems in Texas.
You have them all over
exactly
the country.
Right.
You have them all over the country.
So as I was mentioning, one of the things that we got was sort of a calming provision that says certain types of things the homeowner always has the right to cure before the association can slap a fine. Now, we didn't eliminate fines, which is a difficult proposition. But we did have a little bit of good news, which came out of the court system this year. In fact, fairly recently in October. As you may know, we have a statute here that has been interpreted as allowing judges to impose fines in court of up to $200 a day.
Okay.
And so we had one well-known published case where someone had parked. There'd been a dispute over who has which parking space.
That's what I mean by childish.
yes. But one of the people had said, this is my parking space, and presumably it was because it was close to their front door, and they had parked there for 2 months, and the board was attacking them for reasons that, frankly, I don't know. But what was important was at the end of the case, the judge said that the homeowner lost and, in addition to everything else, had to pay $12,000 for $200 a day for 2 months.
Wow.
Now, I think that statute ought to be unconstitutional, but we haven't won that battle yet. What we did win, and I didn't win this, somebody else won this, but I'm very happy that they did, is the courts have now said that this is a punitive damages kind of an award, and as such, they need to first prove actual damages. If there were no actual damages, you can't impose punishment. And that's the first cutting back on fines that we've seen. As you may know, there are a lot of doctrines in contract law that says that the courts will enforce rules for compensatory damages, but they don't like contracts that impose penalty clauses. And so it may be that now that we have this award, this decision concerning the $200 a day statute, we may be able to cut back on the contractual provisions for fines.
Well, that's a ray of sunshine.
I'm sorry?
I said that's a ray of sunshine.
It's a ray of sunshine, yes. Thanks. So that decision still could be appealed to the Texas Supreme Court, but it gives us a little bit of a roadmap for how we might be able to get some legislative change to either eliminate that or at least cut it back significantly.
Sounds great. So that was a good year.
Yeah, those were some of the very exciting things that we had, and then we also have some plans for next session, and I guess I should start, in terms of talking about next session, talking about what is probably our biggest disappointment from the past year. And our biggest disappointment was with another bill that one of our allies put forward. And that bill would have made the far-reaching proposition. Would have made a law out of the following far-reaching proposition. Every board member ought to read the governing documents for their own subdivision. And you say, well, why do we need a statute for that? And the legislator is asked at the hearing, why do we need a statute for that? Doesn't everybody do this?
No.
And the answer is, I don't know whether they all do it, but there are plenty of them who say they don't.
They don't.
And we think that it's very important to make sure that everybody read their own governing documents, because how else can you fairly decide if you are fulfilling your obligations as a director? For example, you need to, as a director, supervise a property manager. How do you know if the property manager is doing the right thing if you've never even read your documents? And similarly, how can you supervise the enforcement procedures that your lawyer may recommend? So a group of people had put forward this bill that said, first, every director has to read their governing documents, and second, it stated that directors had fiduciary duties to the owners, that is, certain duties of fairness and good faith and fair dealing, that sort of thing. Right now, there is a statute in Texas for new condominiums, and it's based on a statute that's been adopted across the country that says that directors have some fiduciary duties to owners. But the old condominiums don't have that statute, and the subdivisions don't have that statute. And the proposal would have said all directors need to read the rules, and then they have to enforce them with they have fiduciary duties that they have to follow their own rules. And what was amazing was, I mean, I think you have to also understand that all of these associations are nonprofits, and Texas, just like, as far as I know, every other state, but certainly the vast majority of other states, provide a lot of protection for individual directors against being sued. To be sued, you have to, the person who's suing you has to pretty much find an intentional action that the director has done wrong, intentionally violated some rule. It does come up. I had a case where one board president shoved my client, and it was an assault, and the guy was charged with assault, and he's still facing those charges. We could sue for damages for that. And every once in a while you'll get some self-dealing where a board member is personally profiting. You could sue for that. If it was an illegal contract, and it should be illegal, but it isn't always. But mostly directors can't be sued, for money. But what's important is that if they are breaching their fiduciary duties, they can be held accountable. They can be required to do the right thing. They can be required to enforce the rules in a fair way. And the directors resisted this mightily. And we didn't get that passed. However, we developed some allies, and we expect to come back with that in the next legislative session.
So by being held accountable, what exactly does that mean? Give me an example. If I'm on the board and I don't fulfill my fiduciary duties and responsibilities to you, the homeowner, how can you hold me accountable without punishing me? I mean, I would want to punish you because you even wanted to look at the books and records, and that seems to be okay. But I can screw up and yet, hands off. Right?
Generally speaking, that's what happens in Texas homeowner associations. If the directors don't follow the rules, there's no accountability for the directors. So if you ask me, how could there be accountability? Well, one way to get accountability is to have people removed from the board for bad acts. There's no current way to do that in Texas law other than by recall. And the
can you make amends for your actions? Just by removing them, is that going to make any amends or not?
No, not necessarily. And so then one of the questions is who has financial responsibility. A common complaint has to do with, in the older condominiums, so sometimes they leak. When we have big rainstorms, the water comes down into people's houses, into people's units. Generally speaking, it's the condominium association as a whole that's responsible for fixing the roof, and they should be responsible for any damage. But if the director interferes with the normal process and, for example, tells a property manager, no, don't do them in order of priority, do my friends first, you would want to be able to hold that individual responsible financially. Again, it has to be an intentional act for the director to be responsible, and the number of cases where that has been established in Texas is tiny. There was one case in the new condominiums that had to do with refusing to allow repairs. Basically, the condo association said, nah, the homeowner's responsible. And the homeowner said, great, let me do it. And then the condo said, nope, can't do it. So, anyway, our biggest disappointment was not getting that accountability measure passed. And so that's at the top of our priority list for next session.
So that's good. So you've got a list, and
well, we're just at this point in the process of starting the list. So another issue has to do with at the conference we identified maybe a dozen issues. One of the issues, and I think you'll enjoy this one, is actually our honoree Mary Lou Durham said she doesn't understand why homeowner associations are considered to be nonprofit organizations. The typical nonprofit is a charity, and everything about it is voluntary. If you want to join, you join. If you want to make a contribution, you make a contribution in an amount that you choose. If you want to participate in a service that they provide, think hospitals, you get to choose which hospital you go to. Think schools, you get to choose which school you go to. Think music groups, the opera, the symphony, or theater groups. You get to choose if you go to the plays or the concerts, and if you don't want to, you don't have to. Homeowner associations are different. You don't get to choose. You're required to belong. You're required to pay dues. You're required to follow their rules. And, unlike every other nonprofit that we can think of, the homeowner association has its tentacles wrapped around your house.
Yes.
And can foreclose on your house. Hospitals cannot do that in Texas. Universities cannot do that in Texas. Grocery stores cannot do that in Texas. Nobody can take your house, your personal residence, unless they're a bank or a taxing agency like the city, if you don't pay your city taxes, or if they've done some construction on the house and they have what's called a material mens lien. But normal creditors cannot take your house away. They can sue you for money. They can put a lien on the house so that when it's sold, they eventually get their money. But they cannot force a sale of your house. Homeowner associations have somehow wormed their way into a special position of power where they can take away your house. And what Mary Lou's point was, these aren't nonprofit organizations. That's not how a nonprofit functions. And we should stop treating them in any way like nonprofits, and we should start thinking about them like the small governments that they are. And in Texas, people tend to recognize the importance of limited government, and we feel that we're going to try to educate the legislators around this point next session.
I like it.
I thought you would like that. It's a very
like
clever
it.
Idea.
It is a clever
idea. It wasn't why she got the award, but she's been thinking about
one.
These issues for a long time, and that was a We've made the argument before that they're governmental agencies, and to some extent that has traction, but we've never linked that to the contrasting point that they're not nonprofits. And I think it's going to go well when we do that.
I like
looking
that.
Forward to that.
You are right, David. You know me well.
Well, I know you a little bit on this issue. We had a number of other issues that we haven't had a chance to talk about, the issue of ombudspeople here. And we did at our conference talk extensively about whether it would help to have a state official who is available to help homeowners if they get attacked by an association. And there were two very divided sets of opinion in our own room. One group felt that we can't think of an example where an ombudsperson has solved a problem of comparable importance. The best example anybody came up with was in the public utility area, where every once in a while, if you have a dispute with, say, your electric company, you can get some help. But generally speaking, people recognized that was rare, and we felt that even in the more established areas, such as we've had ombudspeople concerning a variety of different housing issues over the years in Texas, just hasn't helped homeowners.
No, they haven't.
The counter argument is it's so damn expensive. Excuse me. It's so expensive to hire a lawyer
to
fight.
Oh, damn it. Say it, damn. Yeah, it is.
And I think all of our group recognized both the importance of both of the arguments. We also all recognize that the odds of the Texas legislature investing more money in any new programs in government are small. But we did want to think of what kinds of educational things can we do to get the district attorneys to pay more attention, get the county attorneys to pay more attention to the board and its wrongdoing, instead of where the county attorneys are more active. They tend to be active in enforcing deed restrictions at the request of politically connected associations. So we'd like to work with these elected officials so that when an issue comes up, they will know that they need to listen to the homeowner's perspective equally carefully as they listen to the perspective of the association.
David, we're sort of coming towards the end of our time here, but can I jump in here with a couple of thoughts?
Absolutely.
You know, We've been treating associations much like a Christmas tree. It's like every year the industry comes and puts another ornament on there, or a couple more ornaments here, and the feds and all kinds of things, to the point where it's just overgrown. It's just way, way, way too heavy, and it's going to collapse. And I've been saying that for a long time, but the more I look at it, the more I see that image. I think if you're going to fix anything, I mean, the reason we have associations, let's be very honest about it, is to give local municipal governments a pass or an ability to double tax, increase taxes without making the politically unpopular decision to do that. So limit the powers of the association to doing what they were initially supposed to do, and take away all of these ornaments. Get them off the tree and reduce it. You don't need to be checking to see if flower pots are cracked or
right. Figuring
out whether or not somebody's hose has been approved, or whether the car you're driving, identical to your neighbor's, has the right make on it, because if not, you're going to reduce property values, or foreclosing because there's a stain on the driveway. You know, all of this stuff is what's creating the problems.
Right.
Get rid of it. Strip them of all their, strip them of all these stupid powers. Strip them of the ability to find. If there's a problem, go to court. have someone there decide whether or not there's, you know, provide some adult supervision, basically.
Well, I agree with that, but I will say to you that in Texas, we're not about to eliminate homeowner associations.
I didn't say eliminate homeowners associations. I did not say eliminate them. I said reduce them to what they were initially intended to do, which is to maintain, pick up the trash. In Virginia, where I live, we have snow. It's not an issue with you guys in Texas or where you live. But what, provide street lights, maintain, you know, provide all of those things. You don't need to be doing all the other stuff, weighing your dog, listening to your dog bark, figuring out whether or not you've got the right colored Christmas lights up. All of this stuff is what's making money for the industry attorneys. All of this stuff is what's turning communities into war zones.
Well, and I think that those are very valid points. I mean, we are trying in different ways to cut back. As I mentioned, I have no idea why they care so terribly much about garage sales. Many people find garage sales an entertaining, enjoyable way to spend Saturday and Sunday afternoons. But some associations seem to feel that without an iron hand telling homeowners how to live their lives, the world will come to an end.
Get rid of the iron hand.
We're trying to get rid of the iron hand. And I do feel that we made some significant progress in this past session explaining why these powers should be curtailed. Haven't gotten as far as we need to be. We're looking at more ways to do that in the future. And I'm cautiously optimistic that we will have good results in 2017.
You know, one other thought on the ombudsman. You said they're expensive. The state is not going to pay for that. It's going to cost the homeowners an additional fee to pay for an ombudsman. We have one in Virginia. And whenever I get a call, and I get a lot of calls from people in Virginia, whenever I get a call, I always ask them, have you contacted the Virginia State Ombudsman? And the answer is always the same, yes, and she's totally useless. And I'll tell you why. Because although we have an attorney who's being paid to be the ombudsman, the only thing she's allowed to tell you is that she's not allowed to tell you anything. And that's what our legislators have gone ahead and done. And that's one of the many ornaments that CAI has put on this tree. So it's costing us additional money to have someone tell us she can't help us.
And I think that in the end, we're going to be looking for other ways to address the concern, the legitimate concern that homeowners have that it's too expensive. So one of the things that we began to talk about, and I'm not saying this is a well thought out idea, this is a first thought out idea, that we might want to give a power to the justice of the peace to hear disputes over attorney fees. And a homeowner could say to the justice of the peace, they've sued me, they want to get my assessments. I've always been willing to pay my assessments. The problem is that they also want, in addition to a $200 assessment, they want $2,000 in attorney fees. Will you cut that back? And if we gave an unreviewable power for the justices of the peace to cut back on the attorney fees, that might be a way that homeowners could do things for themselves without the need to hire a lawyer to fight these battles. Because the problem, of course, is that if it's a $2,000 attorney fee and they call up a lawyer and the lawyer says, well, I need to charge you $500 or more to fight this,
mm-hmm.
The odds that the lawyer is going to be able to save $500 or more are small. I'm not saying non-existent, but they're often small, And before the homeowner gets to that point in time, they have to spend other money.
Yeah.
And of course, the homeowners who fall behind on their assessments are usually homeowners who didn't have the money. I had one lady call me just days before the conference, the Wednesday before our conference on Saturday. And she had a good job in the medical center here. We have a big medical center in Houston. She had a good job. And her job paid her well above the national median income. But she had gotten sick. And she thought, you know, she even had insurance. But she had very high copays. And she thought that, well, she should pay the doctors in the hospital that actually got her better first.
What a choice.
And however moral that decision may have been, the association said no, and they said, your several hundred dollar annual assessment, since you didn't pay that, we're going to try to get several thousand dollars.
Yeah.
And she'd actually paid that for the first year that she had missed. And but what that meant was that once she paid that, then she didn't have enough money for the next year, and they kept trying to do this. So what we need to find is some simple way to have some authoritative figure say, no, you can't charge this much. And then it has to be non-appealable. It has to be that the association cannot then say, well, we want to appeal that, because the homeowner, again, can't afford to fight these battles endlessly. So we're going to look for some kind of a way to at least cut back on the attorney fees.
Maryland passed legislation capping attorney fees for just such incidents because they were spiraling out of control. So that
what are the limits that you have in Maryland?
I don't know. We need to find out. But we really are out of time, David.
Okay.
I want to thank you. I hope you'll come back. Come up with some more stuff. I think you've got a great start.
Well, I think we're going to have another session in another 6 months or so to begin preparing for the elections, and then after we know the elections, we'll be preparing for the session. So I think we're looking at two more sessions coming up. So we'll be
sounds great.
We'll
keep
be talking with each other.
Sounds great. Keep in
and we
touch.
Didn't even talk about the national issues.
Please check out our website at onthecommons.us. On the Commons is produced by OTC Multimedia Productions.
Well, I finally bought my dream home to enjoy retirement life. I've made new friends and buddies, lots of parties for my wife. It seemed that life was perfect, all my neighbors felt the same. Then along came death by CCRs, life's over, I'm fair game. Those petty rules and regulations, it's enough to make you cry. They're full of woes, no pink flamingos, someone tell us why. Slick managers and lawyers slither close, but they won't tell why our dream home should remind us we bought a one-way ticket to hell.